Hello and welcome to a live event, as well as giving a speech during a ceremony. The ceremony is called Loyalty to the Martyrs Leaders. It's held in southern Beirut, and we're going to take a listen to what he's saying.
The last of the prophets, Abi al-Qasim Muhammad, son of Abdullah, and may peace be upon all of his family, may peace be upon all of his friends, and may peace be upon all of the prophets. Brothers and sisters, may peace be upon you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And I would like to welcome you. I'd like to thank you for your participation in this annual commemoration, whereby we once again commemorate the memory and the stances and the history and the heroics and the martyrdom of three of our leaders, the leaders of the resistance. The Sheikh of our martyrs, Sheikh Raghib Harb, the Sheikh of the martyrs of Islamic resistance, Sayyid of the martyrs of the Islamic resistance, Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, and the commander, the jihadist commander of the martyrs, Haj Imad Mughniyi. However, allow me, before I speak about the main subjects of my speech, allow me to express our deep sadness and our condolences, and we also, of course, give in here to God's will. We have lost today, for the first time for 20 years, we have lost the presence of the beloved, blessed Sayyid Abu Hussein al-Musawi, the father of the martyr Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi. May peace be upon both of them. And he is at the same time the uncle of Yasir, the Mati Siham al-Musawi, the wife of Sayyid Abbas Musawi. This person, it's enough that he is a father of our Sayyid, of our teacher, of our leader, of our beloved, the dearest to our hearts, our former Secretary General Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, may peace be upon his soul. And Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi was raised by his father. This Sayyid Abu Hussein, the father of Sayyid Abbas, after the martyrdom of his son, he was always present in every commemoration, in every occasion for the resistance, although he was a very old man. He used to go to the front lines ever since 1992, specifically after the martyrdom of his son, Sayyid Abbas, and he suffered from some sickness, and I told him, don't make yourself tired. He said, no, when I go, when I'm old and when I'm sick, if I go, because I'm the father of Sayyid Abbas, because I participate with the people and eat with them, with the fighters, I get cold like just like they do, I get thirsty just like they do. This increases my morale. And he also went and visited the injured, the families of the martyrs. His presence in all of the occasions, despite his health condition, his bad health condition, I bear witness that this great man, he had the ability to preserve, to participate in the preservation of this resistance and strengthening it, and not allowing this resistance to be nailed. And he always participated in this. And today, it's quite nice, actually. It's no coincidence. There's nothing which is called a coincidence. Everything big and small in this earth is subject to God's will. And what is very nice about God's will and destiny is that Sayyid Abu Hussein has passed away on the same day as his son was martyred, his beloved Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi. So, God willing, we make the pledge after this father has left us, and his sadness was in his heart, but he always made jokes and behaved in a happy way. He always was in good spirits and always smiled. And so I pledged to him that we will preserve his soul, we will preserve what his son spoke of. And on this occasion, I would like to express my condolences to the Mousawi family, especially the direct relatives, his brothers, his sons, his grandchildren, his daughters, all of his grandchildren, all of his relatives, all of the people of Nabishid, the village of Mousawi, and our people in Biqa, all those who loved Sayyid Abbas Mousawi and the resistance and its supporters. I express my condolences to all of them on this painful occasion. And to his cleansed soul, we read the Fatiha with the prayers on Prophet Muhammad. On the commemoration of the memory of the martyrs, on this day every year, we speak about their resistance, we speak about their cause, we speak about their jihad, we speak about their achievements. Of course, to speak about the uniqueness of every person will be a long conversation, because every one of them, Shaykh Raghib, Sayyid Abbas, Haj Imad, each one of them, really, fairly, to be fair, everyone has their uniqueness, which is very important, very high uniqueness, and they were also unique people in more than one direction, in more than one area. However, on some occasions, in the previous commemorations on February the 16th, I spoke about the commonalities between these three martyrs. And previously, I spoke about many commonalities. Last year, I said that one of the commonalities for these three martyrs is that they laid the foundations, they were the founders of this resistance and this march, and this party specifically, the party of Hezbollah. They founded, are the founders, and one of the first people, some of the first people who contributed and participated and worked in order to further strengthen this body. And thank God we had help, and so for this reason the party grew and achieved victories and made a lot of achievements. Today I would like to add, when it comes to the commonalities between these three people, these three martyrs, these three leaders had a big impact, a very, very big impact on preserving the principles and the rules, the building blocks, the culture and the mindset, the path, if we could say, of this resistance and of this party, party of Hezbollah. And these martyrs, these three martyrs, we owe a lot to them, of course, in addition to other brothers who are still alive now, and we don't ignore how they have contributed as well. However, usually we speak about the achievements or the contributions of the martyrs. We leave those alive to later. These leaders were able to preserve this path, and this path is still, we are still committed to it. Hezbollah is still committed to this path, and we will remain committed to it. This is one of the main reasons why we are continuing on our same path. This path has not changed, has not been derailed. Our stances haven't changed, our alliances haven't changed, our vision hasn't changed, and our strategy hasn't changed. When it comes to tactics and details, there is some change allowed here according to the circumstances and the conditions, the changes which occur. I'd like to say that in any house, if we build a house on a shore, for example, on sand without foundations, any wave can wipe away this house. However, if we build a house with weak foundations, also an earthquake can destroy, make this house collapse. If we build a house with strong foundations, it might stand against hurricanes, it might stand against strong winds. So in such a country like our country, in such a region like our region, which is also always witnessing political and military and security earthquakes throughout history, we must always strengthen our foundations. We must make buildings which are based on strong foundations, solid foundations, so that this house, this building, can stand and withstand and protect its people, protect its inhabitants, preserve the dignity of its people, reassure the people, keep them comfortable, keep their stability. What goes for buildings, the same thing goes for people, groups of people, human beings. Whether we speak about family, or whether we speak about groups, whether we speak about tribes, about religious sects, about components of society, about a people, about a government, about a community, about a state, about a party, about an organization, a movement, a political group. The same thing goes for all of this. Any human group, any group of human beings which is formed, which doesn't have a clear path, which doesn't have clear foundations, and also any group, any society, any country which isn't based on strong foundations will go with the wind. If any change, if any international regional change, if any hurricane comes, if any earthquake comes, we will find that these human beings will collapse, will fall, or will back down from their true identity, will derail, or have become something else, if they're not based on strong foundations. This is a rule, this is a holy rule, which we've seen throughout history when it comes to human beings. Whoever doesn't have a clear path, clear foundations, clear strong principles, which are the base of his vision, of his speech, he becomes very weak and will go with the wind, will shake with every wind which comes. With the blessing of these martyrs, of these leaders, with their sacrifices, with their lives, with what they said, with what they did, with their jihad, with their resistance, with their blood, with their martyrdom, they have laid the foundations, very strong foundations for this resistance. And so you found and you will find, God willing, that this resistance after 30 years, ever since its founding and in the future as well, this resistance is a strong resistance, a solid resistance, a resistance which stands on its own two feet, a high level of assurance and confidence. And the main theme is this ceremony, the leaders, the martyrs, who have a will which doesn't know defeat. This is the main theme of the resistance which the martyrs laid the foundations for. And when we speak about the issues which I'll speak about tonight, and I spoke about them before, we are not basing what we say on our mood. Our mood isn't the basis of what we say or our stances. If we're upset, we break alliances. If we're happy, we build alliances. No, it's not about our mood. It's not about our sympathy or about our feelings. It's not about our anxiety. It's not about our personal interests, nor is it about the interests of our group. It's not about the interests of our political party, no. Here, we always focus on the greater interest, the interest of the ummah, the interest of the nation, and the interest of the people whose dignity we are defending, whose independence and sovereignty we are defending, and we are part of the people. On top of this list of the strong foundations, name it what you want, or on top of this path, we have the issue of the stance towards the Zionist project. Zionist project in the region. First of all, understanding this project, the true nature of this project, the background of this project, the goals of this project, the far-reaching aims, the danger of this project, its plans, what it's based on, what it's based on internally and foreignly, the strong points it has, the weak points it has, its presence, the current atmosphere, its horizon, its future, etc. To understand, and after we understand, we make our stances, and we understand that Israel, the entity which stole occupied Palestine, it is the entity of this project, it is the state of this project, it is the military of this project, it is the tool of this Zionist project, this big, dangerous Zionist project in the region. And we make our stance based upon our understanding of a Zionist project. We make our stance based on our personal humanitarian orientation, our moral orientation, our beliefs, our national orientation. And then we take our resistance action against this project, this hostile project, this aggressive project. And here I must draw your attention to a point, brothers and sisters. The danger of a Zionist project, which is represented by Israel in this region, its danger includes the whole region. And when we take from this project and from its entity and from its military and from its state this hostile stance, first of all, because this project occupies today Palestine, and it occupies the holy sites of the Muslims and the Christians in Palestine, and it's also working on the Judaization of Jerusalem al-Quds, and this project brought about all of this injustice and suffering to the Palestinian people inside Palestine and outside Palestine, and it is still doing so today. This is first of all. Second of all, because we believe, and the facts also prove that what we believe is true, what we say is true. It proves that the Zionist project is a danger to this region, to the countries of this region, to the governments of this region, to the people of this region, to all of the components of the peoples of the region. Whatever be the religion of the people, Muslims or Christians, whatever be their race, Arabs, Kurds, Turkmens, Persian, whatever they may be, whatever be their civilization, it's a danger to all of these governments, all of these countries, all of these peoples. And so we must all confront this danger, and we must confront this project and overthrow this project. And actually, every resistance fighter in any country, in Lebanon or in Palestine or Syria or Egypt or Jordan or Iraq or Iran or Yemen or any country, and especially in the neighboring countries, when such a resistance fighter stands against Israel and makes resistance against the Zionists, he is defending all of the Ummah. And our martyrs, our leaders, and all of the resistance fighters and the martyrs who fell in Lebanon, they were defending Palestine, they were defending Lebanon, they were defending Syria, they were defending Jordan, they were defending Egypt, they were defending every Arab and Muslim country in this region which is subject to the Zionist threat, the Zionist hostile, dangerous threat. We don't have to go back to this, because this, you got to know this Zionist project. We've spoken about it for 30 years. I want to take advantage of the time to speak about other points. And so this is the main way, the best way to measure and to evaluate and to study and to correct and to take the initiative and to make our alliances and to take our stances. This is one of the most important ways from which to base our stance on. So based upon this, we evaluate our own behavior. We, Hezbollah, the sons of this resistance, one of the main factions in the resistance in Lebanon, our behavior, our performance, our alliances, our speeches, our movement, does it serve this path? Does it serve this cause? Does it serve this priority or no? And based upon this, we correct and we measure, we evaluate. If there are some tactics, if in some areas we made mistakes, we correct. And second of all as well, via this, we can evaluate and we can look at others, whether they be people, figures, institutions, parties, movements. I'll leave the countries until later, in Lebanon or in the Arab region or in the Islamic world. What is the stance of these people towards Palestine? What is their stance towards Jerusalem al-Quds? What's their stance towards the Zionist project? And how do they act? How do they behave towards this stance? This is also something. However, in this era of time and this time, the priority is for the Islamic parties and the Islamic movements which are being witnessed in the Arab world. They must evaluate themselves in this way, and we must evaluate ourselves in this way, and we must be evaluated by our Arab and Islamic people in this way, especially when I'm an Islamic person or when I'm an Islamic movement. There are issues which might be accepted to be delayed. There are some issues which might be expected, which it might be accepted not to speak of clearly. However, when it comes to the cause of the Ummah, when it comes to the cause of Palestine, the cause of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, the danger of a Zionist project to the Ummah, to the religion of this Ummah, to the Muslims of this Ummah, as it is also a danger to the Christians and Christianity, I, as an Islamic movement in any Arab country or Islamic country, cannot but have a clear-cut stance, against this issue, towards Palestine and Jerusalem al-Quds and the resistance in Palestine, and towards Israel and the Zionist project in the region. And also, when we speak about the countries and the governments, to evaluate and to make our alliances or to take stances towards these regimes or these governments. For more than 60 years, ever since the Zionist entity came to exist after Palestine was occupied, in our Islamic and Arab country, we had governments. Some of these Arab governments or Islamic governments, some of them actually collaborated with the Americans and the Westerners and the Israelis against Palestine and against the interests of the Ummah. Some of them helped in order to preserve this entity. Some of them helped in strengthening this entity. And some of them helped to push issues towards making the Ummah desperate, making it hopeless when it comes to achieving victory against this entity. They tried to convince the people of Palestine and the people of the region to accept a settlement with American conditions and Israeli conditions. And I can say that some of the regimes, some of the Arab regimes and some of the governments in the Islamic world were very loyal to the Americans and to the Israelis, and they pursued all the efforts possible in order to achieve the goals of this project, unfortunately. There are also other Arab governments and Islamic regimes, other Arab governments and other Islamic governments who worked in a different way. They were preoccupied with their internal situation and were far away from this conflict. They also take responsibility. The betrayal of Palestine, the betrayal of the Palestinian people, the betrayal of Lebanon, the betrayal of Syria, the betrayal of Egypt and Jordan, which also had territories which were occupied and still are. And there are also other regimes and governments, who from day one, they had a stance of resistance, of rejection. And these regimes, because of their resistance stance, they took the repercussions, they suffered the repercussions, isolation, sanctions and big conspiracies, because they supported the resistance. When I belong to this school of resistance, when I belong to this cause, when I belong to this understanding, to this way of thought, whether I am a Muslim or whether I'm a Christian, or whether I'm an Islamic, meaning my ideology, or whether I'm a nationalist or an Arab, is it right, is it fair to look in an equal way, between the regimes who did the impossible in order for Israel to stay and in order for Israel to achieve victory, and on the other hand, between regimes who did all they could so that Palestine would stay and so the resistance would achieve victory? Is it fair? Is it fair to treat them equally, look at them equally? Then all hell breaks loose. And those who were silent and sold out and isolated and left alone and conspired, they become the defenders of the people and the dignity of the Ummah. And the opposite is true as well. How can this be? We need this way of thought to understand what's going on around us in this era of sedition and divisions, brothers and sisters. What do they call it, sedition or divisions? If it was really clear, there wouldn't have been any divisions, because people, they look at what's right. If it's clearly wrong, then there wouldn't be any sedition as well. However, they take what's right and they take what's wrong and they blend them together, mix them together. They look at part of what's right and they take a stance. Others look at the wrong part and they take a stance as well. And what is true is that the whole cause must be looked at in general, looked at deeply, in a frank way, in an objective manner, without behaving vigorously or hastily. So here I'd like to speak about the issues of the region, and I'd like to end my speech with a response or some comments after what we heard in Lebanon on February the 14th. And I'd like to conclude also by commenting on the bombings which are happening, or which have happened out in the outside in some foreign countries, which targeted Israeli targets. When we speak about the issues of the region and what's going on in the region in more than one country, one of the best ways, or one of the correct ways to look at the issues, is to look at them from the angle of Israel itself. Israel, its current situation, its strategic environment, how does it evaluate its threats, how does it evaluate its dangers, how does it act, what are the chances which Israel looks at, where is Israel now, my dear brothers and sisters, and all those who are listening to me, where is Israel now towards what's going on in the region, especially in Egypt and in Syria and in Iraq and in Lebanon and in Palestine, first and foremost. Of course, this angle is a very important angle to look at issues in the region, the Israeli angle. The Arab peoples and the Arab governments today, they are all preoccupied far away from Palestine, preoccupied with other issues, unfortunately. There are some who are always preoccupied and far away from what's going on in Palestine. However, now, the main event on the minds of everyone is Syria. I'm not saying Bahrain, because the people of Bahrain are left for their destiny. The Arab League isn't expressing any concern. The IYC isn't saying anything, nor is the United Nations, nor is the Security Council. Nobody cares. This is part of the great injustice. At the beginning of the events, or the main concern today, is what is going on in Syria. And what's going on in Egypt is also very sensitive. Let's look at Israel now. We are preoccupied far away from Israel, but the Israelis are continuing with their project in occupied Palestine, the Judaization of Jerusalem al-Quds in East Jerusalem, displacing the inhabitants of Jerusalem al-Quds, and the detainees also in Palestine. They are all suffering. Mr. Khudr, for the detainee Khudr, and the hunger strike which we saw for more than 60 days, this has continued, the danger of death because of the stance which he took, because of the challenge he made. Where is the Arab League? Where is the Arab world? Where is the Arab media? If Khudr Adnan was an Israeli, would the world have acted in this way as they act today, with a person who is subject to death, who is demanding what is rightfully his own? If Khudr Adnan was an Israeli, the Arab governments would not, on the highest levels, would not have intervened. If he was an Israeli prisoner who was taken captive by the resistance, the kings and the Arab presidents, Arab leaders, wouldn't have intervened in order to bring about guarantees for the safety, for the healthy condition of an Israeli captive. Isn't this something which must also shake us? This is continuing today. However, if we go even further in the Israeli mindset, we will find that the anxiety and the ambiguity, at least, I don't want to overreact, there is ambiguity and anxiety and confusion in the Israelis' minds now when it comes to the developments in the region. And this is something which was expressed by the Israeli officials, the political and military and security officials, in more than one occasion. A few days ago, there was an annual conference which was held the Herzliya conference, whereby the most important Israeli military, political and strategic and security officials speak. And unfortunately, some Arabs participated in this conference. This is something which we condemn, something which is unfortunate as well. They spoke, these Israeli officials. I don't have enough time because I have a lot of points which I want to mention, but it's enough to say that the main headline was anxiety, concern on the Israelis' minds. Not strategic concern or security concern, concern an existential concern. It's enough for me to quote some of the Israeli officials. Ehud Barak made a speech in the Herzliya conference, and he said that the challenges, the political and security challenges which Israel is facing, are more fatal than the challenges which our founding fathers faced, meaning at the beginning of the founding of Israel, during the days of Ben-Gurion. He said they are more dangerous than the challenges which we faced before, and the challenges which were faced by our leaders during the Six-Day War of 1967, and the challenges which we faced in 1973, meaning in the most important three periods which Israel faced. Barak considers this current period is even more dangerous. The challenges and the threats are even more dangerous. But it should have been the contrary. Israel would go towards more strength and more resistance. Of course, Israel today is speaking about its concern and its existential danger, not because of the poetry, not because of the parties which are being seen. It's because of the resistance, jihad, the politics, the will, the martyrs, the resistance, the sacrifices. Netanyahu also, I'd like to quote what he said. He said something with a similar meaning, and so did the Israeli Joint Chief of Staff. However, before the Israeli Joint Chief of Staff, before the July 2006 war, before Hosni Mubarak was overthrown, and before the Americans had withdrawn from Iraq, what did Netanyahu say at that time? He said that the 1967 war represented for Israel a step from a state whose existence was in doubt. Would Israel stay? Wouldn't it stay? Which was founded in 1948. After the 1967 war, it became a state which cannot be defeated. And after the results of the 1967 war, and after the war of 1973, the Arab people had the idea that Israel could not be defeated. Victory and deterring, the Israeli victory and the Israeli deterrence were decisive in the Arab countries, reaching the conclusion that they must recognize the existence of Israel and establish peace with Israel. And in this way, some peace agreements were reached with Egypt and Jordan, and reached possible settlements with the Palestinians, possible settlements. However, listen, but I continue with the quote. To the whole, all the Arab world, and especially the Lebanese people, and especially here, I'd like the March 14 people to listen. However, after the unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon, and after the withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, and for what reason did this withdrawal happen? And after the second Lebanese war, meaning the July 2006 war, the situation changed, and it became clear. This is Netanyahu who's speaking, who is the current Prime Minister. It became clear that Israel is no longer a country which cannot be defeated, and there are questions being posed about its continued existence. These questions are being posed again, not only by Israel's enemies, but also these questions are being raised by Israel's friends. This was said before Hosni Mubarak was overthrown and before the Americans withdrew from Iraq. So what can we say about now? And so, concern is what occupies the minds of the Israelis, and anxiety is what occupies their minds, because I don't want to exaggerate the strength of Israel is going backwards. The strength of the Zionist project is going backward, is decreasing. Very quickly, the adoption and the American support and the use of the American influence, the American political and security influence in supporting Israel. Today, America and the West are going backwards in our region and in the world. And one of the settlements, one of the main parts of the settlements which was going along. Now this settlement has ended. One of the main parts of strength is the presence of regimes which made service or gave service to the Israelis and stopped or made one of the strongest countries exit the confrontation with Israel. This was the Hosni Mubarak regime. However, Hosni Mubarak regime has fallen. And so whatever be the situation after Hosni Mubarak, it won't be as bad as it was during his time. And so they made condolences. They felt sad towards what's going on in Egypt, but they feel happy towards what's going on in Syria. In Iraq, Iraq was a strong wall which protected the eastern part, not of the Arabs, it protected the eastern part for Israel, the eastern border for Israel. Netanyahu says today that Iraq has been transformed into an Iranian ally and an ally of the resistance axis. The Iranian military reputation, the strong reputation, has also fallen in Lebanon and in Gaza. The military strength is one of the most important parts of Israeli strength in general. However, this military strength has also decreased. There's no longer this big reliance on the military strength. The wars on Lebanon and the war on Gaza has proven that the air force power in the hands of Israel, which is the strongest air force power in the Middle East, cannot decide the result of the battle. And the infantry also cannot decide the result of the battle. And the ground troops stood for days and fought against the heroes in Lebanon and in Gaza. One of the most important parts of the strength of the enemy was the weakness of the Ummah, the weakness of its people, of the Ummah. But now the enemy speaks about the strength of this Ummah, the strength of this resistance, the strength of resistance countries, the countries who reject, especially when they speak about the rockets. Meir Dagan, who was one of the most important security officials in Israel, he's the head of the Mossad, or the former head of the Mossad, I believe. When he turned over his position, when he gave his position to his the new Mossad chief, he said Hezbollah has rocket capabilities and firepower the same as 90% of the countries of the world have. This is what he said. This is the head of the Mossad, not a foreign minister. Neither is he a member of a Knesset or a strategic expert. He's the head of the Mossad. Is it strong? Is it right? God maybe only knows. However, it's enough for the Israelis, to believe that the Lebanese resistance possesses firepower which is not possessed by 90% of the countries of the world. This is enough to be a deterrent against any assault. This is enough to protect the country. One of the other strong elements of the enemy was the coherence inside Israel, the culture, the readiness for sacrifice. This is also going backwards. And we saw some internal problems in Israel. The Israelis today, they are facing big threats they speak about. However, they also have opportunities. They still have opportunities. When I speak about the Israeli opportunities, I'm not saying this in order to just buy time or to speak, but in order to prevent the Israelis from taking advantage of these opportunities. They are saying this, not me. They consider that the only chance, the only opportunity they still have in Egypt is for a new president to be elected and for there to be an alliance between the military and the president to disrupt or to put a halt to the popular will. Otherwise, chaos. You, my beloved Egyptians, you, the honorable Egyptians, in every security incident, in every issue of chaos, in every sectarian issue in Egypt, in any battle, any source of instability in Egypt which happens, look for the Israelis, look for the Americans. They are behind it. In Iraq as well, their opportunity in Iraq is chaos and internal confrontations. After the Americans failed in remaining in Iraq, in staying in Iraq, the Israelis have a chance, have an opportunity also, which they speak about in Syria, which is to overthrow the regime. Here, Barak and some analysts, some analysts, I'd like to refer them to what Barak says. Barak says that leadership isn't always between two options, good or bad. It might have two options, between good or between bad and even worse. So they choose the bad instead of the worse. And today, there is an Israeli consensus that any choice in Syria is better or less worse than the continuing presence of Bashar al-Assad, the regime of Bashar al-Assad. This is their chance. This is what they believe. Israel today is waiting. It's depending. It's relying. And Israel believes that the strategic environment which has come about in the region on Israel's account, the only hope it has, the only hope it has in order to change and reverse the strategic environment is to overthrow the regime in Syria. Some say Israel isn't sure about the alternative. No, they believe any alternative in Syria is less worse, if not better. God knows. We don't know the agreements, the deals which are said, because the opposition or the group or the side which becomes under the auspices of the Americans and the West and the Arabs, whom history we know, and the Israelis, they shouldn't be worried about this, the Israelis. Brothers and sisters, Muslims and Christians, to all the people, I say, let's just look clearly. Why do we have this insistence on overthrowing the regime in Syria? Why? Isn't it strange, really strange, for America and Europe and Israel and the so-called Arab moderate countries who take responsibility of all the catastrophes in Palestine and in Iraq, in Iran, and the people of the region over the past decades? Isn't it strange? And Al-Qaeda as well, for all them to come together, all of them are coming together around one goal. They insist on accomplishing one goal, to overthrow the regime in Syria. From our perspective, from our point of view, based upon our belief, yes, we stand and we stood before, and I said this in Nabishit, in Sayyid Abbas's home territory, can anyone say or doubt that the Syrian regime is a regime of resistance? Whoever likes the regime or not, let's speak about the facts. This regime never surrendered. It never bowed down to the Israeli-American conditions. It didn't sell out the resistance in Lebanon, nor did it sell out the resistance in Palestine, nor did it sell out the resistance in Iraq. When Colin Powell came with his long list, one of the demands on his list was that Bashar Assad should turn over Khaled Mash'al, the beloved Khaled Mash'al, and the beloved Dr. Ramadan Abdullah and Mr. Jibril and Mr. X, Mr. Y, Mr. Z. They demanded of Assad to take steps against the resistance in Lebanon and in Iraq and in Syria and in Iran, towards Iran as well. In any step, who prevented the Syrians? If Feltman had spoken to other countries, wouldn't they have behaved in a different way? This regime, the regime of Bashar al-Assad, stood against the Israeli-American project in the region and supported the resistance movements. Yes, the Syrian regime does have some negative aspects, and the regime itself recognizes this. But let's put this aside. But what we can say is that some say they didn't open the front of the Golan Heights. Whatever be the response, is that you who speak about this, did you open a front against Israel? Did you fight against the Israelis? Did you practice resistance? Did you raid? Or did you help the resistance? Or didn't you close the doors towards the resistance and isolate the resistance and prevented money from reaching the resistance, even prevented donations from reaching the resistance? If you had behaved a different way, okay. And so we are looking at such a regime. Now, this regime in Syria doesn't need reforms. Yes, everybody is calling for reforms, including the people of the regime themselves. Today, from the beginning, the regime and this leadership, they said that we are ready to go towards reforms. And they began. to make laws, the law of political parties, the law of the media, the law of local administration, other laws as well. They put together a committee to amend the constitution, a complete committee, and I remember in those days when I was speaking on the occasions with my brothers, even in the internal meetings, we were sure that the Syrian leadership wants reforms and will take steps towards big reforms. In one of the meetings with one of the leaders in Lebanon and in the Arab world, they told me that the Syrians won't make any reforms. Will they cancel Article 8? I told them, yes, I'm sure they will. This is my own information, not my analysis. I said, I'm sure. They said, you have illusions. I said, I'm sure. I said, I'm sure they'd cancel Article 8 of the Constitution, the article regarding the Ba'ath Party. Will they accept, will the Syrian regime accept election of the president? Will they accept specifying a term of the president? Will they go seriously towards reforms? Yes. I said yes to all of these. And from the beginning, they said, we are ready for reforms, we are ready for dialogue, and they went very far in this. What was demanded out of reforms? Was it more than what we're witnessing today? We have a new constitution. In 10 days, there will be a referendum. And after that, parliamentary elections. However, on the other hand, they insist on military confrontation, they insist on rejecting dialogue, they insist on overthrowing the regime. What is the logic here? What is the logic? Why? Why do they insist on overthrowing the regime? The double standards, which are very clear, and I want you to focus here, these Arab governments, let's put America, Israel and the West aside, these Arab governments, they say, what's the solution with Israel? The Arab governments respond and they say, a political solution. There is no other choice but negotiations and dialogue with Israel. Is there a time ceiling, a time frame? No. For how long have they been negotiating? Tens of years with the Israelis who occupy, the killers, the Israeli killers who have done all this. But they're patient with the Israelis. And they say there is a Arab peace initiative which was made after 2000. Now we're in 2012. This peace initiative is still on the table. Where is it? It's still on the table. The Israelis don't accept it, not the Arabs. With Israel, we negotiate for tens of years and the choice is a political choice. But go ahead for a political solution in Syria. They say we don't have time. It's too late. How? Explain this to me. Let me assume that the regime in Syria is just like the regime in Israel. But you accept a political solution with Israel. You accept dialogue with Israel. You accept negotiations with Israel. You accept a settlement with Israel. Why, with an Arab regime which has a lot of positive aspects and some negative aspects, why do you reject a political solution? Why do you say there's no more time? Why do you say it's too late? Tell me, where's the logic here? I'll tell you what the logic is. And nobody tell me, Sayyid Hassan, you're going too far in this. No, I'm not taking a stance based upon my feelings. Some say this is loyalty. Yes, it's not only loyalty. This is a vision. This is a clear path. This is the interest of the Ummah. And the days will come and we'll see and we'll ask one another. Okay, they prevented arms from reaching the resistance in Palestine, and they prevented arms, or they tried to prevent arms from reaching the resistance in Lebanon. They did this in Palestine, prevented arms from reaching the resistance, and those who were smuggling weapons were tried. But in Syria, no. The Arabs announce in public they will pay money and send weapons in order for the Syrians to fight one another. Why? In service of whom? For the sake of whom? For who? Whose sake? Can you tell me? This insistence, this Arab, Western, American, Israeli insistence on no political solution in Syria and on fighting in Syria and on overthrowing the regime in Syria, doesn't it call for us to stop and think? Within the same context, let me speak of Bahrain and then I'll speak about Lebanon. Even in Bahrain, when it comes to your way of thinking, if you're with the people, why aren't you with the people of Bahrain? In our school of thought, yes, the people of Bahrain, they support resistance in the Palestinian cause. They are committed to the Palestinian cause. They are committed to confronting the Zionist project. I'd like to remind you, when the war began on Gaza, the first people in the Arab world, the first people in Arab and Islamic world who went down to the streets were the Bahrainis in support, in solidarity of Gaza. Anything the Bahrainis did for Gaza, can do for Gaza, I believe they're ready to do it. And when they protested in support of Palestine and in support of Jerusalem, of course, they were subject to bullets by the Bahraini authorities. You can go back to the archives and look at this. And if in Bahrain there had been a government which had been elected by the Bahraini people, this government would stand completely in support of the Palestinian people. However, the regime or the current authority in Bahrain, we all know where it is. We all know it stands towards Israel. We all know what there is in secret and in public and the meetings which took place on television screens. However, at the same time, the Bahraini people are left alone. Okay. So now I'd like to speak about the situation in Lebanon, my dear brothers and sisters. For the sake of Palestine, for the sake of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, for the sake of Lebanon, for the sake of Syria, for the sake of Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, for the sake of the whole region, the big opportunity for Israel is chaos. The big opportunity for Israel is sedition, which aims to go and incite people, which aims to spread lies, which aims to do all this. Do we give Israel this opportunity? Israel is the one which is living an existential concern. Of course, Iran's progress worries Israel a lot. The development in a nuclear arena, although the nuclear program is civilian, peaceful, 100%. However, the Israelis, we in the Arab world, I don't know for how long we speak, however, the Israelis think 20, 30, 50 years ahead. They believe that the possession, Iran's possession of peaceful nuclear energy, what does it mean militarily? What does it mean in the equations of a region? This is the way the Israelis think. And we must look for a political solution in Syria, a political solution in Egypt, a political solution in Lebanon, in Iraq, in any Arab country, even in Bahrain. We're looking for a political solution. We must prevent the Israelis from fulfilling the opportunities. We must not open the doors of our countries for sedition and divisions. And here I'd like to speak about Lebanon. 2 days ago, on February the 14th, we had the commemoration. And I forgot to say something as well. What Bashar Assad has done until now, the reforms he has taken and the decisions he has taken, the amendments he has made, did any or can any Arab or king or prince or sheikh take such steps like Bashar Assad did? If we find any formal reforms being taken, we'll find the whole world clapping for them, applauding them. The first of them, America. However, when we see serious reforms, the Americans make fun of them. Why? Because the Americans don't want reforms. They want to destroy Syria, to sabotage Syria. They want to destroy Egypt. They want to destroy Iraq. Because in this way, Israel will stay. And in this way, America will regain or will strengthen its hegemony over the region after it was weakened. In Lebanon, as I was saying, we had the commemoration, a beloved commemoration to all the Lebanese hearts, the commemoration of the martyrdom of Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri and other martyrs as well who fell in that event or that incident. And we always express our condolences to the family of Rafiq Hariri and to his loved ones, and we condemn these types of assassinations. As time passed, the occasion of commemorating Hariri's martyrdom, the speeches, the stances, some might say that let's speak of something else. No, because we people of dialogue, we people of logic, and we respect the minds of the Lebanese, we respect the other sides, whatever be their rhetoric and their language. In the end, we are not people who want to cancel others out. as some accuse us. We recognize the others, we recognize the existence of others, and we say, what's the problem? We'll talk. We want to talk on the media, we talk on the media. When it comes to dialogue, I'll speak about dialogue. And there's also a public opinion who's listening to them and must listen to both points of view. I want to speak about this in order to reach the results, and I want to go through some points very quickly and very transparently. First of all, any call for national dialogue without preconditions is a good call and something which is accepted, and we support such a call and we will participate in such a dialogue without preconditions. Let me be precise. Any call for national dialogue without preconditions, we support it and we will participate in it. And in any dialogue, all the members on the dialogue table agree to an agenda. Nobody imposes points on the other. Nobody imposes conditions on the other. They accept, yes, we are ready to discuss this point, that point, and let's go ahead and meet, let's hold dialogue as much as we can. However, if the call for dialogue is to call for conditions, this is not a real call for dialogue. This is just to score points. I don't want to impose my understanding on what I heard in the Hariri commemoration. Is this a dialogue with conditions or not with conditions? Because it's a bit ambiguous. I hope I can have a clear response, a clear answer. Is it dialogue without preconditions or with preconditions? Dialogue without pre-results or dialogue with pre-results, which aimed to be imposed by dialogue. The second is a real dialogue. We're with the first, of course. Second of all, let me speak to the March 14 Alliance. Of course, it's all within the same context. Of course, I have to respond because a lot of what was said, a lot of the verbal attack was against us, against Hezbollah, and the calls made to Hezbollah. Okay. Thank you. Of course, a lot of it was focused on Syria, on the Syrian leadership, on the Syrian regime. I would have preferred in some of the language, in some of the terms, even if I want to name, when Dr. Samir Jaja spoke, he spoke about the massacres, if someone else had spoken of massacres, it would have been better. If the Carlos Iddi had spoken about it, it would have been better. I don't want to go into such an argument or debate, but even when they mention the Fathullah issue, that's for us, not against us, to remind us of the Fathullah massacre, the martyrs of Fathullah. They're for us, not against us. They show that our relationship with Syria is a strategic relationship and our vision is a strategic vision. And even when some Syrian officers made mistakes against us, when they put us on the walls and when they killed us with their bullets, we didn't fight Syria for the sake of Palestine, for the sake of Jerusalem al-Quds, for the sake of Lebanon. Now, with respect to those who were killed by the militias, by the troops of some who speak about massacres, for the sake of whom were they killed? For whom were they killed? This is something else. I would have wished this door wasn't open. So you came and you focused your attack, very strong attack, the three people who spoke, you focused your attacks on Syria. The fourth speaker, what can we say? I forgot the Lebanese expression. If his first presence, the first presence of the Syrian National Council, Syrian National Istanbul Council, the spokesman of them was Fedez Suaid, that is a very good start. I don't speak of names, but I'd like to create a good atmosphere, because when we speak about strategy a lot, it might make you bored, so this is just to create an atmosphere. a joking atmosphere. So why? Why did you say this? Is it for the Lebanese interest? Is it in the interest of the Christians in Lebanon, in the interest of the Muslims in Lebanon? Okay, I'd like to go back to the past a bit. I think I've been speaking over an hour, but you have to put up with me. The March 14 must have a clear path, must have cohesion. They say we don't have cohesion. No, I can discuss this with you. I have a clear vision. I look from this vision towards Egypt, Tunisia, Libya, Syria, Bahrain, Iraq, Iran, Moscow, China, Paris, London, and Washington. From one vision, there's one way. I have one way of looking at this. Tell me, what's your clear path? Remember, less than 1 year ago, I made a speech. I spoke about the Arab revolutions and I spoke about Bahrain. Of course, all hell broke loose in the March 14 alliance. And I told them, my dear colleagues, get me some quotes. They got it from Al-Nahar newspaper. I don't want it from any other newspaper, from Al-Nahar newspaper. Also, here I have the names. Prime Minister Saad Hariri, may God heal him, at that day he launched an attack on us and he said that a few days ago stances were made by important leaders in Hezbollah which focus on putting Lebanon in part of the movements which are being witnessed in some brotherly Arab countries. And he considers that these stances were double standard. And Hariri considered that Hezbollah stance is the other face of the coin, the other face of exporting division in the Arab world and exporting sedition and division in the Islamic arena. And Hariri also says that the Lebanese people in general and the Islamic people in general, Sunni, both Sunnis and Shia, won't stand and put up with this. Why? And won't allow for opening the doors for any adventure. Listen very well. This is Saad speaking. They won't allow for opening the doors for any adventure on the account of Lebanon's interest and its ties with its brotherly countries, Arab brothers. This policy of Hezbollah, meaning our stance towards Bahrain, is rejected by most of the Lebanese who don't want Lebanon to drown into the policy, the regional policies. And Hariri considers that Hezbollah's call is not only about intervening in Bahrain. He also says that Hezbollah's call lays the foundations for putting the Lebanese or some Lebanese, putting them in roles which export fatwas and take the decisions away from authorities. And Sheikh Saad adds that solidarity with the Arab people is something and increasing the fire of Arab disagreements is something else. And Lebanon will not be a bridge, will not be a bridge to take disagreements to any Arab brotherly country. Al-Nahar newspaper on the 23rd of March 2011. This was said. Put this in front of your eyes and look at the speeches of March 14 Alliance just 2 days ago. Where is this logic? Where is the clear vision which they have? Where is the clear direct path which they have? Why do you send arms and money? Why do you fight in the media and in politics? And you in the March 14 movement, you're all involved in money and in weapons and in the media and in the stance and in creating all the conflicts in Syria. You're involved in this. In increasing the conflicts, you're accusing us? Okay, but what about you? Why? You want more? When one of our colleagues was arrested in Egypt, one of the Hezbollah members was arrested in Egypt, and we had the issue or the file of the Hezbollah cell in Egypt, you remember the stupidity at that time. They said that our people, the Hezbollah, was accused of overthrowing the regime and changing the structure of the country and expanding Shiaism in Egypt. But the whole issue was smuggling weapons and ammunition to the Gaza Strip from Egypt. All hell broke loose in the March 14 alliance. They said Hezbollah is getting Lebanon involved in this. Hezbollah is putting Lebanon into conflicts. Hezbollah is making the Lebanese go into issues which they cannot be part of. I'd also like to take another witness, not Sheikh Saad this time. Let's speak about Jaja, Samir Jaja. Jaja, let's quote what Jaja says and compare this to what he said 2 days ago. Jaja speaks about this event. He says that Hezbollah members have reached Egypt, and he says that this cannot pass by in any country. This just cannot pass simply by, whatever be the intentions. And he also says, Jaja, he's speaking, he says that no party can allow for itself to go against the laws of another country, regardless of the stance of this party or that party towards the policy of this country or its laws. Do Syria's laws allow you, and do they allow the March 14 alliance to smuggle weapons and incite people in Syria against one another? Do they allow this? Do they allow you to smuggle weapons into Syria? If smuggling weapons to the resistance fighters, to the oppressed who are fighting against the enemy of the Ummah, and this is very clear that they are oppressed, it's very clear that their cause is clear, if this is condemned, how can you do this when it comes to something regarding Syria, which needs us to stop and look? And so I call on you here to look, to stop and look, and deal with us in your ways, in your standards. And here I'd like to speak about a third point, which is also a piece of advice. I'd like to tell you, you in the March 14 Alliance, you attached all of your choices with one issue. You had nothing to present, no action. Now, there is one point which they're taking advantage of, some weaknesses in the government, but all governments in Lebanon have weakness. But what do you have? Go ahead. Just like before, you're relying on foreign developments. All the speeches are very clear. They're waiting for Syria. And they are very convinced that the regime in Syria will fall. And they also were convinced before, and they were incorrect. Yes or no? So isn't it a mistake today for you who speak about neutrality and Lebanon before? I don't say Lebanon comes first. Do I lie to people? No, I don't have the equation of Lebanon comes first. I have Lebanon comes first, but there was also a second, third and fourth. Not Lebanon comes first and a full stop. Yes, Lebanon first and etc. However, Lebanon first, full stop, I don't have this. Never did we lie and say this. You who speak about neutrality in the March 14 Alliance, you called for neutrality and neutral stance with Israel. You spoke about the ceasefire agreement. Lebanon is a weak country. Why should it take the burdens of the Arab-Israeli conflict with Syria? Why don't you take a neutral stance? Take a neutral stance. We make our mistakes. Leave us alone. Leave us to make our mistakes. You attached everything with one issue, which is the fall of the regime in Syria. There are two realistic assumptions. What have you prepared for these two realistic assumptions, which have an effect on Lebanon, of course? What have you prepared for? What have you prepared your people for, the country which you believe that you care for? There is one assumption, which is that the regime, the Syrian leadership, the Syrian people, with their reforms, there will be positive reaction with reforms and issues will be addressed, and this situation will be overcome. This problem will be overcome. What will you do then? In the end, this enmity and this conflict and this incitement and this participation in the events in Syria, would it have an effect on the Lebanese-Syrian relations in the future? This is on one hand. On the other hand, another assumption is, may God forbid, things slide in Syria towards a civil war. Of course, I believe the biggest possibility is the first scenario, the first assumption. I don't think the second assumption will be realistic. Let's assume there will be a civil war in Syria. This is what Israel and America wants, and they're working for this day and night. In that case, what have you prepared for in Lebanon? And you accuse us, and I tell you it's wrong, but you are dragging Lebanon into this issue of war. Why do you deny these two assumptions? What have you prepared for in these assumptions? Number four, one of the conditions, can you put up with some more? One of the conditions is transparency, clarity. We who sit down on a table of dialogue, in the end, Lebanese have no choice except to sit with one another. We must know one another well. Everyone must express himself very clearly, very transparently, what they think, what they want. Okay, I'll give you two examples. The first, when it comes to the financial issue, last week, I made a speech and I said I want to speak transparently. And this is the time to speak in this way. We, very frankly, we are people who are clear. Our arms and our support is from the Islamic Republic in Iran. And we thank the Islamic Republic. And we pray, Salat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, for this. Some in the March 14 movement said that this is condemnation. This is, they're confessing. Okay, condemn me. What about you in March 14? Where's your money coming from? From where? From 2005 until now, the March 14 Alliance has spent on its activities, on its events, on its parties, on its leaders, and on the elections, parliamentary elections, it has spent over $3 billion. And if they want, someday we can give them the details. Each person, the money he got, and how he spent this money. These $3 billion, from where did they come? Is it rude? I say Iran. Who do you say? From where's your money coming from? What's the problem? Say it. Be honest with yourselves. Be honest with your people. Be honest with your country. Before I speak about the other issue about the bombings which have targeted Israeli targets, where did your money come from? For the sake of what? I want to hear say, Iran didn't give money to Hezbollah and didn't give arms to Hezbollah because it's a Lebanese political party. No, they gave it because it's a resistance movement against Israeli occupation. It's supported, and supporting resistance movements with money and arms is something legal and something part of international norms. And human history is full of this. Countries in the world support resistance movements, but you're a political movement, a political party. You have nothing to do with fighting Israel. Why $3 billion? And you're still doing this. The tap stopped. The water stopped going down from the tap. I don't know if it's open again, once again. Your economic projects are clear. You got this from your fathers? Okay, that's clear. This is one point. The second point, when it comes to the weapons, why aren't you clear as well? We're clear. People, we have weapons. Make a poem out of it if you want. And on more than one occasion, we said that we are increasing our armament, and we can get every time we can get weapons. We increase our quantity, and we also improve our quality. And there are weapons which are known, and there are weapons which are hidden and which are unknown. So why don't you come to the people, tell them, hidden not because we're ashamed of them, no, because we want to protect our country, and we must hide away from the Israelis. What should we hide away from them? We must hide the surprises from the Israelis. For this reason, we have some unknown weapons. So why don't you? They say weapons. Why don't you say that you have weapons in the March 14 Alliance? Why don't you confess that you have weapons? We can see them on television, in the streets, on different occasions. And then one of the leading figures in the March 14 Alliance says that Hezbollah is speaking about the weaponization of others to justify the Hezbollah's possession of arms. That's a lie. Is there any Hezbollah figure who spoke in this way? No, never. We, when we speak about the arms of the resistance, we have only one justification. These weapons are to defend Lebanon, to liberate the territories, to confront the Israeli aggression, to confront the Israeli threats. Other Lebanese, if they have weapons or they don't have weapons, that's something else. If no Lebanese person had any weapons, we hold on to our weapons until due course, in order to defend Lebanon, until any development happens. We don't justify our possession of weaponry. We don't justify our possession of weaponry with others possessing weapons. We justify the possession of our weapons with defending our country and protecting our country. Whoever has a witness or something else, come, go ahead. And who prevents building the state? The Zilzal rocket, which targets Tel Aviv, or the Klashen, or the RPG, or a hand grenade, which is stolen, which are used in robberies, which are used in divisions where people fight one another. What prevents stability? Or the rocket which protects Beirut on account of Tel Aviv, or protects southern Beirut by threatening to target Tel Aviv? So the issue of weapons, and very clearly, yes, I say we have weapons. Come and say we have weapons, and let's discuss this. In the national defense strategy, are your weapons beneficial or not? Are our weapons beneficial or not? And we'll decide. Also, are you convinced, or are you convincing people speaking here to the March 14 Alliance, that the Arab Spring was born from the Cedar Revolution? Really? The Arab Spring was against the regimes which are controlled by Condoleezza Rice and Mrs. Clinton and Feltman. The same people who were controlling you in 2005, controlling you meaning the March 14 Alliance, and are still controlling you. After the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak, you all went. Before the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak, you all went, and some of you walked with the former foreign minister, Ahmed Abul Ghaith, took strolls with him in a foreign ministry. Did you overthrow the regime of Hosni Mubarak and the Arab Spring in Egypt? Another question: if the Israeli war on Lebanon had been successful in 2006, and if the Israeli war on Gaza had been successful in 2008, and if America had been successful in striking the Iraqi resistance, and if the new Middle East, which you were part of, if this new Middle East was established, would the Arab Spring have come into being? Would it have been born, or would our Arab countries have been witness to a very harsh winter and autumn? And last of all, should I take longer? And last of all, to the leaders of March 14, no, they don't like this finger. No, to the March 14 leaders, you are not in the position of people who impose conditions or dictate conditions. If you base your belief on a regional situation, if you think that you're going to achieve victory and it's just within days and you're imposing conditions, you're mistaken. You imposed conditions in 2006 and the war ended without your conditions. Okay. Second of all, to the leaders of the March 14 Alliance, with all due respect to those who had good intentions when it comes to the national issue, you are not in the position of people who give guarantees in Lebanon in light of the changes which we are witnessing. Because the game in the region is bigger than you. Do you have the decision to give guarantees? And number three, everyone who cares for preventing sedition and division between Sunni and Shia must work from now to silence their MPs, to silence their media outlets, to silence their allies, to silence their internet sites, which are inciting with a sectarian language of hatred day and night. Taking into consideration these points, I'll go back and say we support dialogue without conditions. There's no problem. Let this happen, and we're ready, and we have logic, and we have evidence, and we are ready to be open. And the Lebanese, their decision is to be with one another and to discuss with one another. And also, we are with political and security stability in this country, regardless of what is going on in the region. And we are also with the continuation of the current government and addressing the crises of this government and addressing its weak points. Because if this government wasn't productive, if it only produces stability at this time, this is something which we regard as positive, which deserves to be preserved. Okay, the last thing is the explosions which we're witnessing in the outside before I end my speech. We, when it comes to the explosions which we're seeing in India and Georgia and Thailand, these blasts or explosions which we heard of in the media, I can assure you that we in Hezbollah, we have nothing to do with this. This is not out of fear. I can be silent and some can say Hezbollah has begun to move. No, we have nothing to do with these explosions. I'll tell you why. Those who have something to do with it, I don't know. Let's not waste our time. But we have nothing to do with these explosions. And in this perspective, I'd like to remind you of something. I said it before and I still say it. Yes, the blood of the Mahdi commander Imad Mughniyeh will always hunt them, will always haunt them, in their dreams, in their minds, everywhere. And this blood will not go to waste. But our revenge, they know where our revenge will come. They know where it will come. Our revenge will not come against Israeli soldiers or Israeli diplomats or Israeli people, normal people. I'd like to tell you, it is insulting for Hezbollah to take revenge for its commander and kill normal Israelis as revenge. This is insulting for us. Or to kill a diplomat here or a diplomat there. This is something else. Those who are targets, they know themselves very well and they are taking measures and they are hiding. And when they travel abroad, they take very strong measures to protect themselves. I'd like to tell them, keep taking these measures, because as long as there is one person, one woman, one child or blood being pumped in our veins in Hezbollah, the day will come whereby we will take revenge for Imad Mughniyeh, a very honorable revenge. Between a close, this revenge, a little small revenge, which is closer, or a strong revenge, which is far, we prefer the strong revenge. And I'd like to respond to other words as well before I end. When it comes to the Israeli issue, I was hesitant to respond or not to respond, but some people advised me. They said, anyway, speak about this And I'll conclude here. Some people have created a vision and they consider that the region will change for the sake of America and Israel. They say this always happened. They say the whole situation will change and March 8, Hezbollah and its allies and the resistance, the people of Hezbollah, come, look at what you should do. And some people reach the conclusion that some in Hezbollah are thinking, in light of the changes in the region, in light of the isolation, the difficult circumstances which will happen, and in our perspective this won't happen. Some people thought that Hezbollah will take advantage of the Israelis. This is something which is rude. And I'd like to remind Sheikh Raqib Harab. He was killed because he refused to shake hands with Israelis. Sayyid Abbas and Hajj Imad and all of our leaders, they fell because this resistance rejected any compromise. And a compromise was proposed. I told you, 2001, 2002, and even now they're ready. However, in 2006, we had no worse circumstances than we had in 2006. No, nothing worse. The whole world was against us. The eight countries, the G8 countries, even Russia and China condemned us. Most Arab countries were against us. The Lebanese government was against us. Although we still were part of this government, but it was against us. The media was against us. Most of the Arab media was against us. Some inside Lebanon were against us. Bombings, most of our people were displaced from their homes. Regions were destroyed. And after that, houses for Hezbollah were destroyed. And it was said that there is no choice but to surrender or to be crushed. One of the national leaders in Lebanon, who is very loyal to us, he tried to make mediation with some Arab countries. He said, apply pressure, stop the war. They said, don't waste yourself. There is a decision to crush Hezbollah. In this atmosphere, they called us, some of the leaders of March 14, in the government, they called us and they said, there is a solution. Israel either wants to crush you and destroy everything, or you must accept turning over your arms, you must accept turning over the two Israeli captured soldiers, you must accept the deployment of multinational forces in south in Beirut and in the airport, in the harbor and on the Lebanese-Syrian borders. In that case, if you accept this, the war will stop. These are the three conditions. If you accept, the war will stop. The first time I'm going to say this in public, in some private meetings, I've said it. I told them that I'm one of those people, ever since I was small, ever since I approached podiums. Of course, I spoke from podiums the first time when I was 15 years old. Ever since then, I read and I study. I spoke about Hussein, Karbala. And you know, every year we commemorate the memory of Imam Hussein. We speak about Imam Hussein, about Karbala. And I don't want to know, say that I understood correctly. However, I told my colleagues, and I'll tell you today, never in my life has a day come whereby I have understood Hussein except, I really understood him except in the first days of the July 2006 war. Why? They told me I have two choices. Either for the war to continue and to be crushed, or to surrender, to turn over your arms, to free the two captives, to abandon Palestine, to abandon your country's sovereignty, to abandon the security and stability of your people, to abandon the dignity of your people, to accept a new occupation under the title of multinational forces like we had in Iraq, either humiliating surrender or being crushed. At that moment, why do you hear me focusing on this? Actually, at that moment, before I consulted with my colleagues, what came to my mind and what came to my heart quickly, directly, was the 10th day of Ashura, when Hussein stood and he said, "You put me in the choice between humiliation and martyrdom, and we are people who are humiliated." I'd like to tell those people, you know us more than anyone else, and to all those who dream that we will approach Israel, you know us. We will never put our hands in the hands of Israel. Our will tells us this. We will never be humiliated. No, God doesn't want this for us, neither does His Prophet, and the faithful don't want this. So we will never accept this. Thousands of people will never accept this. And so our martyrs, like Sayyid Abbas Musawi and Raghib Harab and Ahmad Mughniyi, were very high-ranking martyrs. We are the people of this resistance, and I'd like to tell you, we are staying here. We will continue to be here with this behavior, with this vision, with this clarity, with these norms, and do not be worried about the future. The ones who are worried are the Americans and the Israelis. The weak sides are the Americans and the Israelis today. This sedition, this opportunity for Israel, we will be able together to confront this opportunity with our vigilance, with our will which doesn't know defeat. And assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Live from Beirut, you're listening to Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah delivering a very strong speech. This is an annual commemoration which the resistance holds each year to pledge loyalty to the path of martyrs' leaders, Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, Sheikh Raghib Harb, and Haj Imad Mughniyah. Comments on the Zionist project in the region by the name of Israel were some of the comments he made, in which he said Israel poses a danger to the whole region, Israel stole occupied Palestine, Israel has pursued the Judaization of Al-Quds, and he said we must all confront this project and overthrow this project. Every resistance fighter from any country should stand against this project. Quickly, though, on Syria is where a majority of his speech lied. He said that Syria was a government of resistance, still is, didn't sell out Palestine or Lebanon. Today there's an Israeli consensus, he said, that any choice is better than the rule of Bashar al-Assad. However, he said, why is there this insistence to overthrow the Syrian governments? He said the Syrians are committed to reforms in which he, as an example, eliminated Article 8, he said, regarding the Ba'ath Party. He said the Arab governments have said in regards to Israel, throughout all these years and decades, there's a political solution with Israel. There's no time frame that they have placed. But why on Syria has there been this pressure? That was the strongest point that he made regarding Syria. He said, why is this approach to Israel? But the opposite being true for Syria, since they insist there's no time that the President Assad needs to step down. He says to keep that in mind in the foresights on Syria. On Bahrain, he said it seems like Bahrain is left out in the cold. The OIC has done that, the UN has done that, and so has the Arab League, criticized the Arab League for that. On Lebanon, he talked about the March 14th alliance interference in Syria's affairs in terms of smuggling weapons, and on the explosions that occurred in India, Thailand, and Georgia, which allegedly were targeting Israeli diplomats. He categorically rejected having any involvement, but he did say that if Imad Mughniyah's blood were to be taken revenge on the behalf of Hezbollah, they would not. It would not come in that form at the expense of normal Israelis. He said those targets, they know who they are. When they travel abroad, they are scared. Just some of the highlights of what the Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech. We're going to return now to our regular programming here on Press TV.